I want to start is with a number. Those of you who like numbers, enjoy this number. It's probably the only number we will use all day. Those of you who don't like numbers, endure this number, and it's all words from here on in. But this number, I think, captures the very essence of risk communication, so it's a good place to start. If you make a long list of hazards, and you rank order them in order of something like expected annual mortality, how many people they kill in a good year, and then you take the same list of hazards, and you rank order them in order of how upsetting they are to people, the correlation between the two rank orders is approximately 0.2. Those of you who have studied statistics may remember you can square a correlation coefficient to get the percentage of variance accounted for. If you square 0.2, you get 0.04, a glorious 4% of the variance. Or, and here it is without numbers, the risks that kill people and the risks that upset people are completely different. If you know a risk is dangerous, that tells you almost nothing about whether it's upsetting. If you know a risk is upsetting, that tells you almost nothing about whether it's dangerous. This 0.2 correlation appears to be universal. If you replace mortality with morbidity in the calculation, you're not killing people anymore, you're hurting them or making them sick, and you correlate morbidity with public concern, it comes out 0.2. If you're not worried about either of those, if you're worried about ecosystem damage, correlation between ecosystem damage and public concern is 0.2. If you look at social impacts, you get 0.2. If you look at economic impacts, you get 0.2. It doesn't seem to matter what your measure of harm is. Whatever your measure of harm, across a wide range of situations, the correlation between how much harm that situation does and how upset it gets some public is this absurdly low 0.2 correlation. The key intellectual question in risk communication is, why is the correlation so low? The key practical question in risk communication is, how do we get it higher? How do we get people more concerned, more upset when a risk is serious, and less concerned, less upset when a risk isn't serious? Now, a long time ago, back in the 1980s, and this correlation is not my work, it goes back to the 1950s, and it's work that was initially done by Richard Wilson at Harvard, but going back to the 1980s, I coined terminology to try to make sense out of this correlation, and that terminology has become fairly standard in risk communication, and very standard for me. It's my signature terminology, so I want to introduce you to it. And it starts with the word risk, obviously. And many of you may know what risk means to risk assessors, but for those of you who don't, let me define it for you quickly. And please don't write down this definition. I'm going to give you the definition, and then I'm going to trash the definition. But it's very straightforward. What risk means to risk assessors is a multiplication of two things: magnitude, how bad is it when it happens, times probability, how likely is it to happen. And you get your best measure of how bad it is, your best measure of how likely or how frequent it is, and you multiply them by each other, and you come out with something like expected annual mortality. Okay, you know you have a future in risk assessment if you can say expected annual mortality with a smile. Okay, I mean, they don't just expect it, they look forward to it. Now, sometimes that calculation of magnitude times probability is based on hard data. Automobile fatalities, for example, we can go out on the highway and count the bodies. But for most of the risks that generate controversy, and for most of the risks that are generating controversy at your facilities, the data are not usually hard. If we're worried about an acute risk, if we're worried about something like an explosion in a smelter or a refinery, we are in a branch of magic called fault tree analysis, where we multiply the estimated probabilities of events, most of which have never happened. Okay, because of what I do for a living, I go to the scenes of a fair number of emergencies of various sorts, and I've gotten into the habit, after things are under pretty decent control, of asking the people managing the technical side of the event, show me what just happened on your fault tree. Okay, it's never there. It's never been there. Things like it are there. But exactly what happens is never on the fall tree. So we know two things about these fall trees. We know they're missing a lot of branches. Okay. And we know the numbers at the nodes that tell you the probability of going down that particular branch are mostly made up numbers, because most of the branches on the tree, nobody's ever been down. If, on the other hand, we're worried about a chronic risk, if we're worried about people getting cancer from fugitive emissions, for example, we are in a different branch of magic called toxicology. Okay. You all know what toxicology is? And that's where you collect data about what happens to small numbers of rodents exposed to large quantities of one substance at a time over a short period of time. And then you try to draw conclusions about what might hypothetically happen to large numbers of human beings exposed to small quantities of lots of substances at once over a long period of time. Okay. Which is to say, we all know what part of their bodies risk assessors pull those numbers out of. Now, I have to tell you, as a social scientist, this is a source of great satisfaction to me. After decades working with technical people in a wide range of fields, at last I found a technical field sloppier than psychology. Okay. It may not make you similarly happy, especially if it's your field. But the point is, whether the data are hard or soft, what risk assessors mean by risk is this multiplication of magnitude times probability, which is really the multiplication of their guess at magnitude times their guess at probability. And then, because they know they're guessing, there is a norm in risk assessment that's very strong. It's called conservativeness, that says put your thumb on the scale. Overestimate the risk consciously so that you're confident you're not underestimating it, since you can't get it exactly right. So it becomes the multiplication of our conservative guess at magnitude times our conservative guess at probability. But underneath the random error, which is the fact that we're guessing, and the systematic error, which is the policy of guessing conservatively, underneath all of that, what risk assessors mean by risk is this multiplication of magnitude times probability. The core problem in risk communication, and this is the most important sentence of the first hour, the core problem in risk communication is that's not what anybody else means by risk. Okay. So we need to redefine terms. Let's take what risk assessors mean by risk, magnitude times probability. And for the rest of these 2 days, let's call that hazard. And then let's take what the public means by risk, all the things that normal people consider part of the risk and risk assessors define out of the equation. And we'll take this concept apart in a few minutes. But for the moment, let's think of it as one thing and call it outrage. Which leads to the only math I'm going to burden you with today, a new definition of risk. I would suggest that properly considered, risk is equal to hazard plus outrage. Now, technical people hate this formula. I mean, I do a lot of work with engineers, and you can pretty much count on engineers to look at a formula like this and start to sneer a little bit. You know, that's what happens when you let an English major write a formula. So for the engineers in the room, or if you're not a techie, for the techies you work with, I have an alternative version of the formula that techies like much better. I would suggest that risk is a function of hazard and outrage. Okay. If you don't know what that means, that's hazard plus outrage in techie code. The core of what I'm trying to suggest to you is that risk is a function of both hazard and outrage. Okay. And this represents a significant change. I mean, normally what happens is the experts look at a risk and they focus on the hazard and ignore the outrage. Okay. The experts therefore systematically overestimate the risk when the hazard is high and the outrage is low. And the experts systematically underestimate the risk when the hazard is low and the outrage is high, because all they're doing is looking at the hazard. The public makes exactly the opposite mistake. The public focuses on the outrage and ignores the hazard. The public, therefore, overestimates the risk when the outrage is high and the hazard is low. And the public underestimates the risk when the outrage is low and the hazard is high. This is very different from what my clients think. My clients normally think the problem of this 0.2 correlation, is a problem of public misperception. Okay? My clients are endlessly complaining that the public just doesn't get it, okay? Just doesn't understand, just doesn't perceive the risk correctly. What I'm suggesting to you is that far from being a problem of public misperception, this is in fact a definitional dispute. Hazard is what experts mean when they say risk. Outrage is what the public means when they say risk. When hazard is high and outrage is low, the experts are going to take the risk seriously. The public is going to shrug the risk off. And the experts will be tearing their hair out, trying to figure out how to get this stupid public to realize that this is really serious. And some of you who do safety work, I assume the stupid public you're imagining is sometimes employees, is a public of people who are not wearing their PPE, for example. All right, so when hazard is high and outrage is low, that's what's going on. When hazard is low and outrage is high, the experts shrug the risk off. The public takes the risk seriously. And the experts are still tearing their hair out, trying to figure out how to get this stupid public to realize that this is no big deal. Now, when hazard is high and outrage is also high, the experts will take it seriously because the hazard is high. The public will take it seriously because the outrage is high. It's a coincidence. And as soon as they start talking to each other about it, they very quickly come to realize they're not talking about the same thing at all. And finally, when hazard is low and outrage is also low, experts shrug it off because it's low hazard. The public shrugs it off because it's low outrage. It's another coincidence. But you don't spend a lot of time talking to each other about a risk that neither of you thinks is serious. Now let's make it more complicated. Even though the correlation between hazard and outrage is very low, 0.2, the correlation between perceived hazard and outrage is quite high. Okay? Those of you who like numbers, it's about 0.7, okay? Accounting for roughly half the variance. Now, whenever you have a high correlation, if you're any kind of scientist at all, the question you immediately ask is, what's the direction of the causality? So there's been a lot of research on the causal relationship between outrage and hazard perception. And the question that's being asked when you ask that question is, you know, are people upset about a risk because they think it's dangerous? Or do people think it's dangerous because they're upset? Now, that's an important question. If they're upset because they think it's dangerous, the solution is to convince them it's not dangerous. If they think it's dangerous because they're upset, the solution is to stop upsetting them. If you want to manage the system, you need to know its causal structure. You don't want to be in the awkward position of trying to influence the cause by manipulating the effect. That's not good engineering, and it's not good communication either. So there's been a lot of research on the causal relationship between outrage and hazard perception. I'm going to share the results of that research with you in just a minute, but let me test your intuition first. How many of you think that on the whole, outrage causes hazard perception? People get upset for reasons we haven't talked about yet, and because they're upset, they think the risk is dangerous, whether it is or not. How many of you think that hazard perception causes outrage? People think the risk is dangerous for reasons we haven't talked about yet, and because they think it's dangerous, they get upset. Okay. The first group is right. The second group is also right, but less right. In the research, it's a cycle. There are arrows in both directions, but the arrow from outrage to hazard perception is very strong, very robust, and the arrow from hazard perception to outrage is surprisingly weak. Okay. So for the most part, it is not true, that people get upset because they think a risk is dangerous. It's much more true that people think a risk is dangerous because they're upset. Okay. Okay. And the same is true on the other side. It's not the case, for the most part, that people are calm because they think something's safe. It's much truer that people think something is safe because they're calm. Outrage is the engine of hazard perception. Hazard perception is not the engine of outrage. Okay. And off in a corner, we have hazard, which isn't the engine of anything. Now, I'm not arguing that hazard is unimportant. I mean, hazard is obviously enormously important. If you have a choice between killing people without upsetting them or upsetting them without killing them, it's probably a better idea not to kill them than not to upset them. So I'm certainly not arguing that, you know, your company can afford to ignore hazard. Okay? I am arguing that hazard has very little effect on hazard perception and very little effect on outrage. It's important for its own sake. But quite apart from hazard, outrage and hazard perception are yoked at the hip. They are very closely tied together, but in a direction that half of you found surprising. Outrage is mostly the cause. Hazard perception is mostly the effect. Now, this begins to make sense out of something that most of the people in this room have experienced. You go to a public meeting, and let's assume that you're operating a factory, and the meeting is neighbors of your factory who are worried about your factory's emissions of dimethyl meatloaf. Okay. You are emitting too much dimethyl meatloaf in their judgment, and they think your dimethyl meatloaf is giving them and their family cancer. Okay. So they've come to the meeting to talk about dimethyl meatloaf emissions, and in front of the room is a technical expert hired by the company who says something like this: we've done a quantitative risk assessment on this risk, and we have determined scientifically that the odds that anybody in this room will die as a result of this facility's dimethyl meatloaf emissions are less than 1 in a million. Okay. And you're booed. And someone stands up in the back of the room and says, "You're lying. We're all going to die of leukemia." And there's tumultuous applause. Been to meetings like that? And you ask yourself, what does it take to applaud the idea that you're going to die of leukemia? And the answer is outrage. When people are outraged enough, they would rather believe they're going to die of leukemia than believe you're not the Antichrist after all. Okay. And under those circumstances, you're going to have a very difficult time convincing them that they're not going to die of leukemia. They want to die of leukemia. Okay. Or to make the point more carefully, they want to believe they're going to die of leukemia so they can hang on to their outrage at you. That's not because they're stupid. It's not because they never studied mining engineering. Okay? It's not because they're manipulated by sensational media or radical activist groups. It's certainly not because they're members of the wrong social class or the wrong ethnic group. It's not because they're aboriginals. It's not because they're not aboriginals. These seem to be the phenomena we're talking about now are universal phenomena. The supremacy of outrage over hazard in determining hazard perception is universal. That happens in absolutely every culture in which I've worked, including the weirdest culture in which I've ever worked, which is the culture of middle-aged white male engineers. If you watch a room full of middle-aged white male engineers in a big city fighting over parking places, you have seen firsthand the ways in which outrage trumps hazard in hazard perception. So these are universal phenomena, and two things are true at this dimethyl meatloaf meeting. The first thing that's true is the audience will resist the data that dimethyl meatloaf doesn't cause leukemia. Okay? They don't want to learn that dimethyl meatloaf doesn't cause leukemia. They will hang on to that hazard perception no matter how much data you present. Okay? That makes sense so far. Everybody agree with that? The second thing that's true is just as important. Let's assume you have terrific data, which is rare. Let's assume you're a terrific speaker, which is rare. Let's assume they're a rational audience, which is rare, but no rarer than the other two. But we're assuming optimum conditions, and let's assume that over the course of several hours, you succeed in convincing this room full of people that dimethyl meatloaf simply cannot cause leukemia. They walked in thinking your dimethyl meatloaf was responsible for leukemia in their community, and you have proved to them with data, laboriously, lots of PowerPoint slides, you have convinced them that that's technically not possible. You pass out a true-false test, they all get the question right. Okay. Now, here's the important question. Here's a $64 question. Okay. During the several hours it took you to convince them that dimethyl meatloaf doesn't cause leukemia, what has happened to their outrage? Has it gone down? Has it perhaps even gone up? What happens to people's outrage when you prove to them that they're wrong? Which way does it go? It goes up. Okay? It's a little bit like Charlie Brown in the football. You have snatched away their ammunition without doing anything about their animus. Okay? So now they have all the outrage they ever had, plus the additional outrage that you have taken away their best argument. Now, just to make sure that everybody understands this is humanity, this is the human condition, this isn't because they're weird. Okay, I want to bring it home. How many of you are married? Oh, good. Lots of married people. I would like you to imagine that you and your spouse, okay, or if you're not married, you and whoever you hang out with a lot, are having a quarrel over where to go out to dinner. Shall we go out for Chinese food, or shall we go out for Italian food? Okay. And let's assume for whatever reason that the quarrel has gotten a little out of hand, and each of you thinks the other is acting like a real jerk. Is this a credible scenario so far? Given this scenario, raise your hand if you have found that a good way to deal with the situation, okay, a good way to save the evening, is to present to your spouse data. Data about, I don't know, the relative nutritional merits of Chinese versus Italian food. Prove to your spouse that you're right, and your spouse is the one who's a jerk, and then we'll have a pleasant evening. Okay. Raise your hand if that works in your household. No hands. Okay. We all learn that. You know, if you don't learn it in your first marriage, you learn it in your second marriage. You know, engineers, sometimes it takes three. But we all eventually learn that in any relationship, the quarrel is about the relationship. All quarrels are about the relationship. The substantive issue is just ammunition that you're throwing at each other. And two things are the same two things that were true at the dimethyl meatloaf meeting are also true in your quarrel with your spouse. One, your spouse will resist the data that proves you're right. And two, if you succeed in convincing your spouse that you're right, your spouse is very likely to pick a fight about something else later in the evening.